content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. First today, This Is Your Brain on Zero by Yasmin Saplakoglu. About 2,500 years ago, Babylonian traders in Mesopotamia impressed two slanted wedges into clay tablets. The shapes represented a placeholder digit squeezed between others to distinguish numbers such as 50, 505, and 5005. An elementary version of the concept of zero was born. Hundreds of years later, in 7th century India, zero took on a new identity. No longer a placeholder, the digit acquired a value and found its place on the number line before one. Its invention went on to spark historic advances in science and technology. From zero sprang the laws of the universe, number theory, and modern mathematics. Zero is, by many mathematicians, definitely considered one of the greatest, or maybe the greatest, achievements of mankind, said the neuroscientist Andreas Nieder, who studies animal and human intelligence at the University of Tübingen in Germany. It took an eternity until mathematicians finally invented zero as a number. Perhaps it's no surprise, given that the concept can be difficult for the brain to grasp. It takes children longer to understand and use zero than other numbers, and it takes adults longer to read it than other small numbers. That's because to understand zero, our mind must create something out of nothing. It must recognize absence as a mathematical object. It's like an extra level of abstraction away from the world around us, said Benji Barnett, who is completing graduate work on consciousness at University College London. Non-zero numbers map onto countable objects in the environment. Three chairs, each with four legs, at one table. With zero, he said, you have to go one step further and say, okay, there isn't anything there. Therefore, there must be zero of them. In recent years, research started to uncover how the human brain represents numbers, but no one understood how to handle zero. Now, two independent studies, led by Nieder and Barnett, respectively, have shown that the brain codes for zero as much as it does for other numbers on a mental number line. But one of the studies found zero also holds a special status in the brain. The fact that zero represents nothing is a contradiction in itself, said Carlo Semenza, a professor emeritus of neuroscience at the University of Padua in Italy, who wasn't involved in either study. It looks like it is concrete because people put it on the number line, but then it doesn't exist. This is fascinating, absolutely fascinating. The new studies are the first to reveal what goes on in the brain when a person thinks about zero, and they bring up broader questions about how the mind handles absence, a pursuit that would have pleased Jean-Paul Sartre, the 20th century existentialist who claimed that nothingness carries being in its heart. The idea of zero, originally called sunya, or for empty in Sanskrit, first made its way out of India to the Arab world. Then in the 13th century, a humble traveler by the name of Fibonacci picked up on the idea in North Africa and brought it back to medieval Europe, along with the base 10 number system and Indo-Arabic numerals. At first, zero caused confusion. Its ability to represent nothing and enable complex mathematical operations challenged deeply ingrained theological and philosophical ideas, Nieder said. Particularly due to the influence of the church, philosophers and theologians associated nothing with chaos and disorder and were disinclined to accept it. Many even feared it, considering it the devil's number, Barnett said. But soon merchants recognized that zero is valuable for business. By the 15th century, it had become widespread in commerce, finance, and mathematics across Europe, but never shed its aura of mystery. If you multiply a number by zero, it disappears. That is really hard to understand, Semenza said. That feeling persists today. Although zero is now persuasive and seemingly simple, math students and mathematicians alike continue to wrestle with it. Zero is the eccentric uncle in the family of numbers, Nieder said. To use zero in calculations, mathematicians had to establish all sorts of rules. You can't divide any other number by zero, but you can divide zero by any other number. A non-zero number to the power of zero gives you one. Zero to the power of a non-zero number gives you zero. But zero to the power of zero gives you a calculator error and a headache. Yet the idea of zero or something that plays the role of zero somehow appears all over math, said Neil Barton, a philosopher of math at the National University of Singapore. Without it, modern mathematicians wouldn't exist. You wouldn't be able to solve a function, do calculus, or distinguish between one and a million. However you look at it, zero is unique. For researchers interested in how the brain handles numbers, zero was the most fascinating number of them all, Nieder said. He suspected that if zero is special in history and math, then the brain must process it specially, too. Barnett was interested in absence before he was interested in zero. The majority of consciousness and perception science over the last century has focused on what happens in the brain when we detect something in the environment. But this ignores the whole other side of things, which is that you can often have experiences of something not being there. For example, if you go to grab your keys and they aren't where you left them on the hallway table, you experience absence. Previously, researchers assumed that absence was represented in the brain by neurons not firing, but recent studies have shown that the brain encodes absence with unique neural patterns. To push this work further, Barnett turned to zero, a concept of absence that all of us are familiar with, he said. A few years ago, Barnett began his absence studies with the number zero. He recruited 24 participants to perform tasks related to zero as they sat in a magnetoencephalography scanner, which looks like one of these old-school hairdresser machines, he said. As neurons fire, they generate voltages, which in turn create magnetic fields that can be detected by the machine. By analyzing the magnetic fields, researchers can learn how populations of neurons respond when prompted to think about specific topics, such as zero. Barnett and his advisor at University College, Stephen Fleming, were looking for evidence of the numerical distance effect, a phenomenon that occurs when the brain processes non-zero numbers. Basically, the brain can more easily distinguish between two numbers if they are far apart on the number line than if they are close together. Nieder, for his part, has been obsessed with zero and absence for the better part of a decade. In 2016, he proposed that the neurological mechanisms that encode absence may be shared with those that encode zero. He hypothesized that zero must have evolved from more fundamental representations of perpetual absence. First, the brain had to understand the absence of a stimulus, like a light being off. Only then could it recognize nothing as a category akin to something, but representing everything that isn't something. Finally, it had to turn nothing into a quantitative concept. By understanding how the brain encodes zero, he believed, he might be able to understand how the brain deals with absence. Since 2015, Nieder has collaborated with Florian Moorman, the head of Cognitive and Clinical Neuropsychology Group at the University of Bonn, who also treats epilepsy patients. For their treatment, these patients have electrodes implanted in their brain, which Moorman can use to collect neuroscience research data with patient consent. As they reported in Current Biology this fall, Nieder and Moorman found the same thing Barnett had, that zero exhibited a numerical distance effect in the brain. That means that, to the brain, zero is just another number, Nieder said. Or is it? When one looks closely, he said, zero is still an outlier among the other numbers. Nieder's team found some differences between the way the brain represents zero and the way it handles other numbers. For one thing, more neurons had zero as their preferred number than the other small number. Because there are more neurons that code for zero, the brain can represent the empty set with more accuracy than it can represent other small quantities, they found. Zero is encoded together with other small numbers, but it is represented more distinctly compared to them. However, they didn't find any difference in accuracy in the brain, the way the brain represented the digit version of zero, compared with other digits. All number symbols are abstractions, functioning as formal symbols within a symbolic system, Nieder said. As such, zero is treated like any other formal number. Nieder's findings are slightly different from Barnett's. Barnett didn't observe any distinctions, even slight ones, in the way zero was represented compared to other numbers. What could explain the discrepancy? After being asked to look at each other's papers, Barnett and Nieder agreed that their findings are complementary. Any differences, they said, most likely have to do with scale. Barnett's study looked at a large population of neurons, while Nieder's looked at single neurons. However, Nieder and Moorman were limited by where their patients' electrodes were placed. They closely examined single neurons in the medial temporal lobe, which is known for processing memory. It's like looking for your lost car keys under the lamppost. The pair might have accidentally surveyed memories for zero, he added, rather than the digit or idea itself. Nieder disagreed. That area of the brain, as well as many others, also has been found to be able to process numbers. Despite the differences, the results excited Semenza at the University of Padua. He had previously hypothesized that zero would have a place on the mental number line and not be a distinct concept from the other numbers. I wish I would have done these experiments myself, he said. All of the researchers agreed that these studies are only the start of uncovering how our brains process zero and how to reconcile its different modes. Neither of the research groups, for example, looked at how the brain processes zero as a written word. How many different zero concepts are there, and how will we be able to unify these ideas under one umbrella, Barton said. Although Nieder hopes to continue dabbling in the world of number neuroscience, Barnett has his sights set on the concept of absence. If we can find similarities in how the mind represents zero and absence, he said, then maybe Nieder's theory is right, that zero might have evolved from a more fundamental ability to grasp the idea that nothing is really something. In case that last article was a little head-hurting to you, let's go to something a little more basic. Our second story, Your Armpits Are Trying to Tell You Something, by Yasmin Tayag. The last time I sweated through my shirt, I vowed that would never happen again. Sweat shame had dogged me for too many years. No longer would armpit puddles dictate the color of my blouse. Never again would I twist underneath a hand dryer to dry my damp underarms. It was time to try Clinical Strength antiperspirant. The one I bought looked like any old antiperspirant, a solid white cream encased in a plastic applicator. But its instructions seemed unusual. For best results, apply every night before bed and again in the morning. Every night? I swiped it across my armpits before bed, and to my surprise, they were dry all the next day. I kept poking them in disbelief. I would later discover that there isn't anything particularly special about this product. Nighttime application improves the effects of any traditional antiperspirant, including those combined with deodorant. The former blocks sweat while the latter masks smell. Research has shown this for at least 20 years. None of the experts I spoke with disagreed. Yet many of us swipe our armpits in the morning before we head out for the day. Somehow, Americans are trapped in a perspiration delusion. Putting on an antiperspirant in the evening feels roughly akin to styling your hair right before bed. Both are acts of personal maintenance that people take not only for their own well-being, but also in anticipation of interactions with others. This idea is reinforced by ads for antiperspirants, which tend to feature half-dressed actors getting ready in bathrooms or changing rooms. For example, the Old Spice guy. These ads also tend to mention how long their products work, 24 hours, 36 hours, implying that their effectiveness starts to fade once they are applied. In a recent Secret commercial, a woman rolls on antiperspirant in a day-lit bathroom, then scrambles to make her bust, relieved that she is prepared for such sweaty moments for the next 72 hours. What these ads don't say is that these products need the right conditions to work effectively. Antiperspirant isn't a film on the surface of the armpit that stops moisture from leaking through, like a tarp over wet grass. Instead, it functions like a bunch of microscopic champagne corks, temporarily sealing sweat glands from spraying their contents. The active ingredient in most antiperspirants is some form of aluminum salt, compounds that combine with moisture on the skin to form gel plugs that dam up the sweat glands. These gel plugs prevent not only wetness but also odors, because bacteria responsible for foul smells thrive best in moist and hairy conditions, according to D. Anna Glaser, a dermatologist and board member of the International Hyperhidrosis Society, a group that advocates for patients with excessive sweatiness. Gel plugs are finicky. They need a little bit of sweat in order to form, but not too much. Antiperspirant applied in the morning isn't ideal, because people sweat more during waking hours when they're active. If their armpits are too sweaty in the hours after application, the product gets washed away before it can form the plugs. The body is cooler and calmer during sleep. For gel plugs to form, baseline sweating is optimal at nighttime before bed, Glaser told me. Nighttime application has been shown to increase the sweat reduction ability of normal antiperspirant from 56 to 73%. But wait, I can already hear you thinking, what happens if I shower in the morning? Here's the thing, antiperspirant lasts through a shower. The plugs won't wash away much, even though the residue and scent probably will. Mike Thomas, a former scientist with Procter & Gamble and an advocate for the International Hyperhidrosis Society, told me. After 24 hours or more, the plug naturally dissolves. Reapplying antiperspirant during the day can be beneficial, Shoshana Marmon, a dermatology professor at New York Medical College, told me. Still, it works best if applied to dry armpits that ideally stay dry enough for the plugs to form. For most people, Marmon added, putting it on clean, dry skin at night provides enough protection to last through the next day. Again, none of this information is new or hard to find. One of the earliest studies demonstrating the value of nighttime application was published in 2004. It showed that applying antiperspirant in the evening or twice daily was significantly more effective than morning-only use. Indeed, the stance of the American Academy of Dermatology is that it's best to put on antiperspirant at night. Media outlets have covered this guidance since at least 2009. For the perpetually sweaty, discovering this guidance only now after decades of embarrassing photos and ruined shirts might spark belief in grand conspiracy. They don't want you to know the truth about armpit sweat. Indeed, it isn't mentioned on the labels of most regular strength antiperspirants. The reasons for this are more banal than nefarious. Most people don't sweat excessively, so applying antiperspirant the usual way is sufficient. Manufacturers may keep instructions simple to fit general habits, so the idea of using antiperspirant at night doesn't always make it into the mainstream awareness. Daniello C. Del Campo, a dermatologist at Chicago Skin Clinic, told me, the difference between antiperspirant and deodorant still eludes many people, and in fact may bolster the insistence on morning application. When I asked brand representatives why so many antiperspirants don't mention nighttime use in the directions, they pointed to a potential for confusion. It's a bit counterintuitive for people to use antiperspirant at night because most people think of applying it as part of their morning routine. Maisha Jones, a principal scientist at Procter & Gamble North America Personal Care, told me, In other words, people are used to applying antiperspirant in the morning because companies don't tell them about the nighttime hack. But companies don't tell them because people are used to putting it on in the morning. Omitting helpful instructions just because they might be confusing isn't doing America's perspirers any favors. The science is well established and the guidance is clear, but the ranks of nighttime swipers may not increase immediately. Routines have to be reset, assumptions picked apart. Some evenings I find it exhilarating to buck the orthodoxy of personal hygiene. Other nights it gives me pause. Applicator hovers over armpit. Brain stumbles on belief. Will this really last past the sunrise, through a shower, beyond the hustle of the day? Even after learning about the science, some people just don't believe it, Thomas said. All there is to do is try. In go the corks, out go the lights. Today's third story is The Fairy Tale We've Been Retelling for 125 Years by Allegra Rosenberg. The clearest candidate for America's favorite fairy tale might be The Wizard of Oz. The author L. Frank Baum set the novel, published in 1900, in a fantasy land that shares core American values: self-sufficiency, personal reinvention, the exploration of wider frontiers. The book's young heroine, Dorothy, is whisked away to Oz, where she befriends magical creatures, thwarts a witch, and leans on her newfound strength and friends in order to return home. For Dorothy, it is a land of empowerment and possibility. For Baum, who perpetuated Manifest Destiny's warped ideas in his other writings, and his many readers, it was an otherworldly representation of American expanse, a place they perhaps wanted to see for themselves. Baum's novel and its sequels were major literary phenomena in their day, but Oz persists primarily through the book's many adaptations, which established the series' enduring iconography. Baum's world is best remembered as it appeared on screen, especially the 1939 musical film starring Judy Garland as Dorothy, a place bursting with songs such as Over the Rainbow, and visuals such as The Yellow Brick Road, which have become the franchise's most memorable features. And with The Wonderful World of Oz's 1956 entry into the public domain, allowing for new, non-canonical works, subsequent generations have iterated on these hallmarks to tell Oz stories of their own. No transformation has been more vital to Oz's longevity than Wicked, the revisionist origin story of the Wicked Witch of the West, one of Baum's most recognizable villains. Based on author Gregory Maguire's 1995 novel of the same name, Wicked's prominence is up there with that of the source text, and yesterday's release of the first part of the musical's highly anticipated film adaptation will undoubtedly broaden its reach. Key to Wicked's success and its ability to bridge Oz's past and future is its canny understanding of what exactly makes the world work so well. Artists across genres and mediums have for decades found great storytelling potential in Baum's characters and mythology, but the mode that Oz has continued to lend itself to best is musical theater, a genre predicated on the suspension of disbelief and thus well-suited to conveying Oz's odd earnestness. The Wizard of Oz's 1903 Broadway musical debut was a hit, firing up demands for more stories, which prompted Baum to write a total of 13 sequels to his book. The Garland film, inspired in part by the success of the musical, cemented Oz's connection to music, but it was The Wiz that brought it back to the theater in 1974. The latter was the franchise's first majorly re-envisioned entry, a celebration of black culture that took Dorothy's story to the 1970s. During its four-year run on Broadway, The Wiz earned several Tony wins. The Wiz showed that Baum's novel could be successfully reinterpreted with a contemporary frame, and its story and characters updated accordingly. The transposition didn't sacrifice the core imagery and themes. Dorothy still fights off flying monkeys and Don's magic slippers to make it back home, but instead retained and even grew their cultural power. Oz hasn't translated as well into dramatic adult-oriented settings, despite numerous writers and filmmakers' efforts. The 1985 Disney film Return to Oz reintroduced the world by utilizing lesser-known characters from Baum's later books. Although it exhibited Oz's compelling peculiarities, such as sentient furniture and disembodied human heads, it was a critical and box office failure, deemed too dark for young viewers. Only McGuire's Wicked, The Life and Times of the Wicked Witch of the West, a tale laden with adultery, murder, and slavery, has taken hold of the popular imagination. Wicked has become the contemporary Oz text, perhaps even superseding Baum's work. It carries forward the original's novel's mix of campy magic and violent spectacle, while bringing in modern literary themes. McGuire's biggest change was recasting Baum's antagonist as the anti-hero, reframing a straightforward villain as a woman misunderstood by her peers, an experience likely more relevant today to today's readers than Dorothy's simpler tale of good and evil. Wicked used Oz's whimsy and weirdness to deepen Baum's seemingly unambiguous world, one strictly divided between right and wrong. The basic premise was a powerful one. What if the Wicked Witch of the West wasn't so bad after all? And what if the wizard and the seemingly perfect society he oversaw was the real threat? McGuire's most important addition was a college friendship between Elphaba and Glinda the Good Witch, one of Wicked Witch's sworn enemies in Baum's novel. The musical turns that bond into its emotional core. The 2003 Broadway adaption led some of the Garland-led film's sparkle to McGuire's story and made it appropriate for an all-ages audience. By foregrounding Elphaba's and Glinda's relationship, the musical emphasized Baum's thematic interest in friendship and self-discovery. Wicked and its own iterations, including its long-awaited film adaptation, which has already become a cultural event, work for the same reason Baum's original story did. They conjure a world that is buoyant, relatable, and unforgettable. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.